This is SaaS Scaled, the podcast where data meets action, with host Arman Shrocki. Each week, Arman will be sitting down with CEOs and industry leaders from the technology sector, giving you the insight to innovate without reinventing the wheel. They'll discuss challenges, best practices, and how to identify the right metrics. So if you want to get to market faster and in a way that matters, then subscribe and join us every week as we discuss SaaS Scale. This episode is brought to you by Curve, the modern no-code analytics solution for SaaS companies on AWS. The tools you need to take action with your data on a platform built for maximum scalability, security, and cost efficiencies. If you're ready to reduce complexity and dramatically lower costs, then contact us today at curve.com. That's Q-R-V-E-Y.com.
Hello, welcome to another episode of SaaS Scaled. I'm pleased to have Peter with me. He's a special guest actually from South Africa, and he has been in the Silicon Valley area for a while, and now he runs the company from South Africa. Very successful company. We will hear more from him directly, but and I will, of course, ask questions that you learn more from him and from the company as well. Peter, welcome to the show.
Hi, Arman. Thank you for the invite and good to be speaking to you.
Can you tell us a little bit about yourself, how you started the company and the company itself, please?
Yeah, I'm Peter de Villiers, one of the co-founders of Clickatel. Clickatel started out really as the first messaging API or interface that allowed software to communicate to a mobile phone many years ago. And we weren't rocket scientists. We were trying to solve a problem. That problem was how to get information from a website to a consumer within an 8-hour window, because the offer were going to expire and be rendered useless. And so we were looking for ways to make that happen. And after many searches on whatever search engine existed at the time, we simply could not find a way to get information sent via text message to a phone. And so we built that as a SMS gateway, four lines of code that you could cut and paste into any software or website. And that really set the company off onto an incredible journey.
Fantastic. Fantastic. And I know that you guys have accomplished to reach to the very magic number of $100 million ARR, and that's fantastic. Not every software company can reach to that goal. So it tells a lot about your business, your software company, and what you are offering. Can you tell us a little bit about also who is the market? Where is the sweet spot for your company? Where is the market? Is it very international? Is it mostly US? Is it amongst all countries? Where do you normally find to be most utilized the software you have?
Yeah, our business is quite mature at this stage, and we have different product offerings. Geographically, we look at it as a third US, a third the Middle East and Africa region, and a third rest of world. So it is a third, more or less. From a sales and customer acquisition channel perspective, we focus mainly on B2B enterprise engagement, but we also have a fairly large self-serve component in our messaging stack. So essentially, we start off as a messaging company, and today we are what we call a chat commerce company, and the value proposition is quite different but complementary, and we see messaging as a gateway to chat commerce ultimately.
Yeah, very interesting. Because as you said, when you merge these two, it can get very powerful, because people start with chatting and then you add the commerce part to it. One question I have for you that is less about the company and more about the topic, generally speaking about SaaS. When SaaS came to market, of course, the biggest concept behind SaaS was subscription. So people, rather than buying software or even deploying software, easily they could use software, but more as a service, and then they pay the subscription fee. What it means that, you know, if they don't like it, it's not helpful, they can stop paying the subscription. One of the topics that, you know, when we briefly chatted before, you mentioned was really it's different when you sell the SaaS in a way versus the SaaS is fully deployed and used and utilized. Can you expand upon that topic a little bit?
Yeah, I think it's important to maybe also understand a little bit of our journey and how we arrived at this moment in time. You know, when we started out, our model was very much a consumption model. So we would typically invoice you on your 30-day consumption of messaging. And that looks a lot more like a communications company than a SaaS company. Mm-hmm. And so what's great about that model is it's fairly simple. And you basically have an accounts receivable book that you can even lend against or borrow against. And so ultimately, it's a fairly straight down the fairway type company. But we wanted to move two core metrics in our business. One was improve our margin. As you can imagine, the communications company's margins are quite depressed and relatively low. And SaaS margins are, you know, in 80% plus range. So we wanted to improve our margins and also get more visibility and predictability on our future revenues, which is difficult other than trend lines and communication side. So we made quite a big bet and investment to say that our clients will go from one way to two way to chat in a progressive evolution of their engagement with their customers. And so we then had to then think about software as a service and the entire SaaS stack and how are we going to invest in taking it to market. And you're right that, you know, the thing about software as a service, the reason why the margins are so attractive is because you have a full stack. You're solving a problem end to end. But it also means that your investment upfront to create that value proposition and that platform is quite significant. And we really had to decide whether we're going to do SaaS sold and deployed from the get-go. Or do it in stages. And so what is the difference between SaaS sold versus SaaS deployed? Well, SaaS sold means you go online, you pick your gold, silver, bronze package, you click through and you check out with the credit card and you're done. So the entire mechanism of getting the product and even using the product. You know, so once you've paid your credit card, you get your user login details and you get off to the races. And no one, you don't need any help. Typically, it's self-serve or low-touch engagement. So that's what we call, in our perspective, around SaaS sold. SaaS deployed, of course, is when you get a client and you onboard each client with the same tool set and infrastructure. And in that way, what you've got is scaled. It's not custom code per customer or a unique infrastructure environment per customer. It's all on one platform, one set of business processes, metrics, and KPIs, and ultimately something that's infinitely more scalable. Now, most SaaS sold companies are by definition SaaS deployed companies, so it's end-to-end. Otherwise, you can't really do self-serve if things don't in the back end kind of remains consistent and the same all the time versus SaaS deployed, you can do, but still have an enterprise sales effort or a little bit more of a manual engagement of how you acquire the customer and how you ultimately contract with the customer. So maybe just pause there. I don't want to go too deep, but that's how we look at it. And in our case, because our SaaS product and value proposition is quite wide in terms of the different components. It's got four core elements: connect, interact, transact, and understand. That's the entire e-commerce stack capable and to be delivered now in a chat platform of your choice. Because of its complexity and the breadth of it, we were going to spend another year and a lot more capital if we tried to do everything sold and deployed in one go. And we decided to do it in stages and then go down market, make it easier for clients to then also purchase the product online.
So when you went through that journey, definitely you have gone through phases. Phase one, that you are exploring different of these models, which one works best for the company, which one is the best fit to the market, optimizing capital, the DNA of the team, and everything else that you have to really measure at that point and say, this is really where we are going to really do it. How do you see now, looking back at what the journey that you took, how would you say this is phase one, this is phase two, this is phase three? Is there any kind of phases in your mind that you have gone through that might apply to many other SaaS companies? Or it was very blended, actually, and you couldn't really say where we started one phase versus the other?
Arman, I think that, first of all, we've made many mistakes on the journey. So I will share with you that the good version of what I feel your question is trying to get at. But it wasn't as a straight line as it will come across in the voiceover. I think what is important, and I have a great CTO, Jeff Dorf, who has got a very clear perspective on things in terms of the product roadmap and vision. So we had a very clear view of what the platform had to be capable of performing and how it will solve multiple customer pain points. So it's I think it's critically important to understand what the end state could and should look like, number one. Then we had to take a very deliberate view on and saying, well, of those capabilities, what is core versus what is contextual? What are the things that absolutely we need to build and own ourselves because of future value around data and security and capability and agility versus what can we plug in out of best in breed in the marketplace? So having a clear view of that was important before you write a single line of code. And then it's about prioritization. What is MVP going to look like? What is the first use case a customer is going to do on a chat commerce or conversational commerce experience that you absolutely have to have available and working on the platform? And so those were the core principles. We also had three more pillars of excellence that we measure our decisions against, because as you can imagine, you in a software service company, there's all kinds of opportunities that come your way, especially if you engage with smart, capable, large consumer brands, and you can get distracted very quickly. And so we ask three questions always. We have three pillars of excellence that we measure our decisions against. One is the economics matter. So if there's a new feature, a new idea, or a new capability that the market is demanding or that we're finding in the market, but we didn't think about, and there's an opportunity for us to go put it into the feature set, then we need to make sure that it can be replicated, other clients would want it, there's margin in it if we build it versus what is the competitive alternative. So the economics matter. Second pillar is the platform matters. Nothing we do for a client can be just for that client. It has to be a feature that gets propagated throughout the platform, available to all customers from that new version, and something that is sustainable, maintainable, and consistent with the architecture and some of the core principles that we have in place. And then thirdly, the customer experience matters. So it's not about the customer matters, because if the customer always matters at all costs, then you'll build a faster horse instead of a motor car. The customer matters in terms of what they're getting in terms of the expectations and the outcome and the results, which means sometimes we have to override a customer because we just know more, because we've failed more in this particular area than they have. And we help them, you know, with a perspective on what success could look like for them.
If you look back and when you started during the first year of customer acquisition, when you started, you know, signing up customers, do you think the first year customers were still, you know, if you wanted to start selling to them today, it still could fit, you know, as a kind of, you know, the best customer profile for you? Or you think at the beginning when you started, the profile was different and now you have a different customer profile or ICP for yourself? Because it happens to many SaaS companies that when they start at the beginning, they have a different kind of set of customers, and then they realize that they need to focus or refocus on some other parts of the customer profile. What happened in your journey with regard to that kind of demographically or profile or segment wise in any aspect?
Yeah, that's a great question. We were lucky in that when we moved the business from a communications messaging company into a SaaS chat commerce business, we already had a strong existing legacy business. And so when we deployed capital to transform the business into chat commerce, we could decide and pick our first customers. That's a very privileged place to be. My answer to you would be very different to when we started from day zero as a company, because then we just put an API into the wild world and anyone could use the API. We would count them as a customer. We were just too happy that somebody discovered us and would use it. So, so that's a very different answer to our SaaS journey. But I think it might be a good perspective to have. And so if you have the luxury, because you've raised enough capital or you have enough runway to go pick your first customers, because you have a very strong perspective of where your product can be successful, that's a very privileged position to be in. We are market makers. So Clickatel, for example, we were the first company in the world to do a payment from within the WhatsApp channel. Also the first company in the world to do banking in that same channel. And so you don't get to be a market maker if you don't take a view and have a perspective to say, this is how it could be and then go for it. And so by going for it, we picked four customers in four different segments because we didn't know which one would pop. One in the travel hospitality sector, an airline. One in the financial services sector, a bank, a retailer, and then a healthcare provider. And then we help solve problems for them with our platform to see to what extent the platform capability is capable. So to answer your question, our first forecast customers, different verticals, different customers, very close to us. We had access to them because we were serving them in our messaging business. There was trust. We have strong brand presence in some markets stronger than others. So we had to pick customers that believed in us to take a risk and go on this journey with us.
Yeah, it's a great go-to-market strategy, to be honest with you, meaning that what you did can be applied in the future as well and for other entrepreneurs to really find something that can be a general purpose, very useful, and widely used by many kind of companies wider than what they want, and then make that technology available in one way or the other. And then they have in their vision, they can add a value added component to it and then go after a subset of that market and take that market and provide something. Now, in your journey, of course, that component was a SaaS based component that you added, and then you picked a subsegment and, you know, subset of it. And but that can be kind of generalized as one of the, you know, best way to go, excuse me, and, you know, for a market. So that to me, it's a good strategy. Would you do the same if you wanted to start your next kind of company? Would you still will engineer the go-to-market strategy to be like that?
Yeah, you know, I think if I go back to my startup days, which were wonderful days, but very stressful days because you just don't know. You know, I simply feel that getting older and having more scars it's a wonderful thing. We still make mistakes, but we make them less often, and we make them less calamitous. And so I do feel that if you have the opportunity at fairly low cost to what I call put things on in the shop front or in the shop window to see what pops, I think then that trial and error is okay. You know, so if what you're building is not that expensive to get in front of customers in different segments and to see who resonates, which persona, which segment is responding to your sort of signaling, then that's always a good way to do, because you don't know what you don't know. But if you're building something that's quite expensive in terms of the stack itself, and we did a $35 million investment just on the chat commerce portion of the stack over a fairly short period, that's a fairly small landing pad that you're trying to survive on. I would not recommend that for a startup, of course, because A, you won't have the type of capital, and B, there's high risk in it. But we were lucky in that we had thousands of clients who really trusted us in our original messaging business. And so we could really have many conversations, deep conversations with them before we, went all in. And so, but to answer your question around early stage, I think if you're scrappy with capital, it's still useful to try things on the glass and see what pops and double click on it.
You have the perspective regarding being in the US, raising money there, and then moving back to South Africa when you realize that you have to get closer to the center and the operation, and then operate from there to be operating all over different regions. Now, after a decade, you look back and you look at SaaS and software industry, do you see it's democratized? I mean, of course, in the meantime, we had COVID and pandemic and other things happening. When we look back 10, 20 years ago, in the way that Silicon Valley was designed, of course, in that domain, in that era, it was very centralized. So you could see that at least in the United States and maybe in the world, there are certain locations, places that attracts majority of the investments. So software starts from those kind of places. I wonder if really in that case, it's something that you see now, it's way more democratized. It's not like just certain locations in the world, the activities happening there, and software and technology companies now have more opportunities to really get started from different places. They don't have to be in particular locations to receive the funding, receive the expertise, do the work. How's your perspective with that regard?
Yeah, I can keep you busy with this topic for quite some time, because it's something near and dear to my heart. I feel, Silicon Valley does have an edge in the context that it will always have access to more capital and lower cost capital than any other region. You can try and recreate Silicon Valley in Brazil, in Israel, in the UK, but ultimately the US IPO market, when that opens up again, the US dollar, the sophistication of venture capital in the Bay Area, those things I feel will always have Silicon Valley at an edge for whichever set of technology is attracting the most capital in the moment. Today, it's Gen AI related investments. So in that sense, it will be very difficult for any other region to compete with Silicon Valley on that basis. That said, I certainly don't feel that the best innovation is coming from Silicon Valley anymore. Silicon Valley has got a particular echo chamber in terms of the universe. And there are incredibly interesting problems that entrepreneurs across the world is solving, number one. Yeah. So I think the biggest and best and most interesting innovation related startups will not come from Silicon Valley necessarily. number one.
Mm-hmm.
Number two, I think founders in emerging markets are a bit more resilient than founders in parts of the US, simply because the capital is so hard to come by. And if you think about, you know, founders of NVIDIA, if you think about many of our great founders have got some foreign country context or birthright or exposure where resilience has become a big deal in their success, the ability to overcome massive odds. And I think resilient founders, at the moment, there's more of them outside of Silicon Valley than inside of Silicon Valley, just in the current sort of, you know, construct. But Silicon Valley is a very special place. We lived there for more than 10 years. My best investors are located there. It will always be an important part for tech companies and the ecosystem. Mm-hmm. I really hope so Silicon Valley ultimately thrives and succeeds, because it's good for the rest of the market.
Okay. When you feel about even outside the US, do you see, compared to the last decade, do you see now more distributed, even if you think about US versus non-US? Because I personally have experienced, for example, some European countries are now way better in SaaS, and, you know, it used to be in some of these European countries. Mm-hmm. I could see a lot of professional services provided, but now I go there and just see product companies. Even outside the European zone, you go to India, there are many product-based companies that started. So it seems like SaaS and software is democratized globally more than ever. And all of these expertise, and, you know, it takes time, but it's happening, right? So that's observing. So,
Armand, yeah, you are correct. I think that, first of all, many of these countries have got incredibly good educational systems with critical thinking and STEM subjects. So the foundation and the brain trusts and the potential in these countries are phenomenal. And so, coupled with podcasts, Medium articles, all kinds of lessons learned and playbooks and literature, these founders who in the past did not have the access because they weren't in up and down the 101, now have access to all of the advice and all of the lessons. And so they are absolutely becoming forces of nature. And I'm an Endeavor entrepreneur, part of an organization. And Endeavor is largely an organization for entrepreneurs from emerging markets, or at least they have more emerging market entrepreneurs than US entrepreneurs, purely by size and demographics. And these are incredibly multi-billion dollar companies that are being built outside of Silicon Valley. So absolutely. And I think one more thing I'll add is that I'm very involved with a project in South Africa called The Collective X. It's all about digital skills for young people, previously disadvantaged people. And you have a growing population in Africa of young, bright, curious minds, and you'll be surprised at what they can achieve with YouTube videos and some instruction, and then of the digital platforms, you know, the world is their oyster. So very excited about the future outside of the bounds of San Mateo and San Jose and San Francisco.
Fantastic, fantastic. No, I mean, definitely the world is a better place when we have a distributed kind of, you know, world, in my view, because as soon as you have, you know, very much too focused in some area or something, then it has benefits. But at the same time, of course, you wanted to see other places also. They have some kind of, you know, activities there and distributions and some technologies coming, and that's the healthy model. Of course, as you said, Silicon Valley, because of the many reasons, including the focus that it has on technology and the funding that available there and some good talents there, it always would be Silicon Valley for software business and technologies and AI now. But at the same time, it's encouraging to see other locations and other places in the US and worldwide are picking up and are kind of also leading in their own way with different fronts on the software technology, and they are innovating, and that's great. Peter, I would like to ask you at the end, if you would please share with us a couple of books maybe that you liked, and either personally or professionally, that you thought these books are great and you loved them and it had positive impact in what you did.
Yeah, I'm quite boring. I read business-related books, not too much fantasy. I don't know, it's always been like that. And we are all spoiled, of course, with so many incredible books. And but the one I cite often would be Crossing the Chasm, in this whole simple idea of the bowling alley strategy, that you have to dominate a particular product for a particular segment before you go, you know, for another product or another segment, but you can't do both. So Crossing the Chasm, I'll put the details perhaps in the show notes, and people can take a look at it. I think management, as a founder, you have to grow a lot as a manager and evolve your management style, and a company can only grow as big as its founder or CEO's ability to grow himself. And there's a book from Patrick Lencioni called The Five Dysfunctions of a Team. He also wrote other books, but I think this idea, simple idea of trust in a management team and how you then build into, you know, meaningful conversations or crucial conversations, that's another book, is very important. So I think the one has to balance between strategies for product and go-to-market versus management practices and best practices, because I think you need all these muscles to stand a chance. It's difficult to build these companies. You are being hit from all sides, often Monday to Friday and then some. And we need all the help we can get.
Fantastic. Thank you very much. It was a great discussion. Glad having you on. I'm glad having you on the show, and hopefully we will get in touch in the future and we will follow your success.
Thank you, Armand. It's been a pleasure, and have a wonderful weekend.
Thank you very much. Okay.
Thank you for listening to SaaS Scaled with Armand Ashraghi. For show notes and any resources mentioned in today's episode, go to saasscaled.com. If you're enjoying our show, give us a 5-star review and share on LinkedIn. And be sure to subscribe for any updates on future episodes. Thanks for listening. This episode is brought to you by Curve, the modern no-code analytics solution for SaaS companies on AWS. The tools you need to take action with your data on a platform built for maximum scalability, security, and cost efficiencies. If you're ready to reduce complexity and dramatically lower costs, then contact us today at curve.com. That's Q-R-V-E-Y.com.